You know, there's a magazine called What Youth, or a website or something that Jermaine found. That's pretty cute. So today we have Katie. Hello, Katie. Great to have you back.
Hi. Thanks.
Putting some regularity into your life. Voluntarily.
Yeah.
Voluntarily. Not, you know, like this office regularity is imposed on you, but this is regularity coming from your own instinct, movement, sex, intellectual, and emotional center. I'm quoting Gurdjieff's five centers.
Yes, yes.
And we have a return person. We have Nadia Renner, who's now a free agent, looking to expand her horizons. Right, Nadia? You're a new world in a new situation?
That's right.
Anything, is this confidential, what you're doing, what you did, or you want to talk about it?
I actually just went public today and announced it on my social media. The funny part is that then Jermaine sent me a link to a news article today, and the Playboy Mansion is on sale for $200 million.
It's on sale.
So it's on sale, so everything's selling, so I got out on time.
Yeah. It seems that's the way. Yes, Dobbstown's taken over. You know where your bread is buttered. You jump to the new scene. Yes, it's
exactly.
Obvious. Now, you're here. Is Jermaine coming? You know if she's here yet?
I don't know.
You're not in touch with her today. Okay, she'll come. And we have Chad or Kate. Is this Chad or Kate?
Hi, it's Chad.
Hello, Chad. Good to have you back. There was some. Let me read you what Jermaine sent me today. They're from Hawaii. She met these kids last week. They're from Hawaii and L.A. And they have a magazine called What Youth. She says the name of their movement and magazine that includes surf, skate, and young kid stuff is What Youth. I invited them to be guests on the show. We'll wait on their confirmation of what Tuesday they will call. This is fun. So isn't that funny? Are we, shall we merge with them?
I think it'd be really cool.
Have you seen their magazine?
Okay, just a minute, Nadia. Chad, you're saying, have we seen the magazine? Is that what you're saying, Chad?
Yeah, have you even seen their magazine or anything?
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now. Looks pretty good. I'm not a... surfing. I'm all for that. Are you looking at it? Whatyouth.com?
Yeah, I see it now.
What's funny, it says What Den, and that used to be Kiggy's name, Den Moo. And the first word I see is What Den. So, Nadia, Chad, pats it down, checks it out for bombs and terrorist jackets. We'll continue with you, Nadia. You were saying something? I think you were saying something.
Yeah, so Jermaine and I were at, it's called Agenda, and it's a trade show, and that's how we were walking, and Jermaine saw like a big, they had like a big poster, and it said What You, and then Jermaine was asking them about it. And it's pretty much like from what the guy explained to us, the concept is like they're taking it back to basics because they were saying like for the skateboard world, they've changed everything. They've made it about like just money and like shoes and more marketing. Like that's not even about the youth. That's not how the movement started at all. The movement is about just skating and like, so where did the youth go that started this culture? So that's kind of like the background that we got from one of the guys there. I haven't checked out the articles, which I'm really interested to read, but I guess that's kind of like what they go about and talk about, like what you like. It just disappeared now. Everything's just all business driven.
That's good. I support that. You know what happened is that the youth inventions, the youth games, were hijacked by the adults. You know, don't trust anybody over 27 or 28. You know, they'll hijack you, turn you into money. So these are, here's Jermaine. Maybe she could clarify. So, Jermaine, you sound like cool people. Shall we have a merger with them? Are we young enough for them?
Right, me and Nadia met them. It was cool. we were walking, and it said in their booth, "What youth?"
Yeah.
So we stopped, and yeah, we had to talk to them and ask them, "What is it? What is your movement, or what are you guys about?" And they're in Hawaii too.
Wow.
Some of them.
What part?
Yeah. I don't know, but they surf.
Probably Honolulu.
And, yeah, they surf. It's like a surf skate and just a bunch of young kids, and they said that they're kind of anti-everything.
Commercial.
So,
they don't want to go. They want to have a youth. They're looking for their youth.
Yeah.
They want to have
so,
one.
It's funny. There's actually like in their interviews, there's a section, and it says conversation with. Interviews with worthy humans. So it just, like, everything has to be worthy. If not, like, they don't, like, I guess the movement is, like, it's just conversation with worthy humans. And, like, they refer to everything as humans or a radical class. And, like, that's how they break down, like, their different things.
Wow.
Even, like, the picture.
These could be parallel worlds. Now, can you, Natty, if you got a better phone, your phone is a bit squeaky. You got a better situation that you can get on? Have you noticed that, Jermaine? It's a bit hard to, she's not as clear as you.
No, I didn't notice that
only...
right now.
Oh, okay.
Oh, maybe because I had you guys on speaker. Okay, how's that?
Go on speaker. Yeah, speaker creates a thinning or something. Okay, so...
Okay.
So we must enter this comprehensively. These could be people from, they could be people who failed to get to the Guff or came from the Guff. These guys may be more than what they appear because they're totally talking us, talking our stuff.
Yeah.
You say under interviews, they say humans, they're trying to retrieve their humanness. I don't see the word interviews on their website. What would that be under? Magazines? Maybe
it
under
says,
magazines.
It's just conversations with. It's like a picture, and it just says it's a guy standing, and it says conversation, and it has like a W. So, it's, and then when you click on it, it says conversation with, and it says interviews with worthy humans. And then you click on it, and then it gives you like the whole interview of that person.
Yeah, what's funny is it, well, maybe I should scroll down. Okay, what youth 10... I do not see your conversational. I see each issue.
Okay, so if you're on the website whatyouth.com, go and click under photos, and then scroll down, and then it's going to be say conversation with. And if you go on there, it says conversation with interviews with worthy humans, and that's where you'll get
worthy,
more of the articles.
Worthy humans. Working humans. And
working
come
humans.
Up. So I'm going back to whatyouth.com, just the main front page.
And go under photos. Right. Oh, photos.
Greg Anderson in welcome. You got to scroll down.
Photos.
No, I'm not going to photos. I'm just doing the front page.
Isn't that what you said, Jermaine?
Yeah, you have to go under photos.
Photos. Click on photos.
I was there. It didn't work.
Well, do it again. With me here, it'll work.
Conversations with, okay?
Okay.
With worthy humans. Hmm. Now, they've got a bit of a snobbish attitude, don't they? we've never had that policy. I wouldn't be here if we had to be worthy humans. That was the original example, was the involvement of me, not a worthy human. Billy Changer, salty mutant pop from the bases of corners. Okay, so, well, that's great. Okay, Kate, I'm going to look up your email. Didn't you say
yeah.
something you wanted to talk about, Katie?
I wanted to talk about The Catcher in the Rye and how that was a for youth
let's
culture.
Go. Okay, let's go.
Well,
that's good.
Okay, so do you have anything that you want to say about it? Bob, do you have any? I kind of went in a different direction than I thought I was going to go when I first started thinking about it and found out some interesting stuff.
Okay, well, the first thing that comes to mind about J.D. Salinger is Ron Rosenbaum. So let me look on. Ron Rosenbaum was a writer very, he actually inspired Steve Jobs and Bill Gates with his article on the phone freak cracker in 1971. Now, Ron is a regular column. It used to be at the New York Observer. I followed him regularly for many years, and now he's at Salon. He's the guy who's on J.D. Salinger's case. So let's just go see. Did you come across...
What do you mean?
No, I didn't. Does the name Ron Rosenbaum mean anything to you? All right. So that we're going to... This could be an aspect you want to include your search in your research. So I'm going to Ron Rosenbaum's thing, and every now and then he has an article. He's sort of obsessed with J.D. Salinger, and he has interesting stories about him. Let's see, Ron Rosenbaum. Okay, go ahead with your stuff while I look.
Okay, so I'll tell you what my experience was, not to get personal with it, but so when I emailed you and told you that this was what I wanted to talk about, I was watching...
Are you on speakerphone?
No, but I'm on a headphone. Hang on.
Can
you hear me better now? Can you hear me better now? Okay, I had headphones on. So I had a documentary on Salinger that I had ordered on my Netflix DVD. Like, I stream and then I get DVDs. And I had forgotten that I had ordered this, so it came and I watched it. And it was fairly interesting. So then I watched another streaming one. And in that particular documentary, there was this woman, Joyce Maynard. Does she mean anything to you?
Hey, wasn't she his mistress or something?
Yes.
Yes,
so
I've heard of her. I think I read her articles years ago.
They were talking to all these various people about Salinger, how wonderful he was, how he... wanted authenticity, and similar to what you were just saying about the What Youth group that Jermaine and Nadia were talking about, how they only want to talk to white women.
That's a really good point, Katie. That is what these kids are, whatever the kid's name in Catching the Rye, that's they're looking
Holden
for.
What,
they're Holden Caulfield, looking for sincerity.
Yeah,
that's good. That resonates with this.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really cool that that's what Jermaine and Nadia were thinking about. But so anyway, Joyce Maynard comes on this documentary, and she began to tell about her experience with Salinger. And then I totally went down the rabbit hole on her and actually had some emails with her over the weekend. She's quite an interesting person. And her perspective kind of changed my mind about what I thought I was going to want to talk about Salinger, because... Now, I think he's kind of a creep, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
So she was 18, and it was 1972, and she was in her first... And I still want to talk about Salinger, but just kind of in this context. So she's at Yale University on a full scholarship. She was raised by super intelligent, artistic parents. Her father was an alcoholic, but in spite of that, was a fabulous painter, and her mother was very literary. So she was a spectacular student and a wonderful writer even before she applied for and got accepted to Yale. And she was so ambitious, which she claims was because she was raised by alcoholic parents, which makes sense. She was just classically seeking approval from a father that was somewhat absent. And so she sent a letter to the editor of the New York Times and many other magazines, like 17 Magazine. She wanted to do an article on the Miss America pageant, so she wrote to the pageant and agreed to be a judge so that she could write about it. She's highly ambitious and really ballsy, like just asked the impossible but obvious to get where she wanted to go. So she sends this letter to the editor of the New York Times and asks if she could write an article for them, and they agreed. So she wrote an essay called An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life, which in and of itself is fabulous, and it talks a lot about youth culture, especially the culture of 1972 and how television affected her growing up. It's a great essay, 15 pages, and they published it. She was an overnight sensation. Along with the article, there was a beautiful, quite winsome picture of her, and she became famous overnight. So she's in her dorm room at Yale, and the following day, three bags of mail appear, and she's invited to do everything, to model, to audition for Linda Blair's part in The Exorcist, which she declined, to write for everyone, to be in radio shows, TVs, commercials. And in among those letters was a letter from Jerry Salinger. And he said that she was brilliant, fabulous, fantastic in every way, and to be very careful because she was going to have so many opportunities at this particular juncture in her life, and she was likely to be exploited. But the words that he chose and what he said to her were so uncanny in terms of what she was actually experiencing. Like, he articulated it to her in a way that was actually occurring. So she really felt like he was peering into her soul. So she's 18. He's 53. This is 72. Catcher was published in 51. He's already a recluse, right? Famous author.
Yeah.
So she's, like, highly enamored, and basically he seduced her to give up her family, her scholarship at Yale, and everything, and move in with him. And so she moved in with
53.
Him. And they were
He's 53, did you say?
Yes, he is 53.
Yeah.
And she is 18. And a very young 18. She'd kissed one boy in her life. So she went and lived with him. And when she got there, he started to criticize her and say things like, "You're acting like a teenage girl," which she was. She got a book contract because of the article and was invited to write an autobiography, and she wanted to publish. She had aspirations of being a writer and has been a writer. She's got 15 books and been on the New York Times bestseller list for, you know, many of her books, and they've been made into movies and everything. Like, she's a very successful author. That was her aspiration. So here's Salinger suddenly criticizing her because he doesn't believe in publishing. He's big into Vedanta. He's denied the world. He doesn't want to be part of the world. He doesn't want to be part of publishing. And so he was really shitty to her. And then after about 9 months, they're on a vacation together, and it's right before her book is supposed to come out. And he tucked two $50 bills into her hand and put her in a cab and said he was done with her. He'd grown weary of her and sent her away. And he was so shrouded in respect and mystery, and the little town Cornish where he lives, if you go there to try to find him and walk into the ice cream store and say, "Hey, do you know where Jerry Salinger lives?" people will get angry with you and send you away. He does not want to be visited. So she kept the secret. She kept the secret for years and years and years until 98. And then she decided to write about her experience. So she wrote another biography, and this time included her relationship with Salinger, and was highly criticized by all the literati. They called her an aging nymphette. They slut-shamed her. They said, you know, thank God she finally said what she said, because now we never have to read another word from Joyce Maynard. We're really horrible to her. And if you want to interrupt me at any time, interrupt me. And so that got me thinking, you know, about some of the other things that I had read about him in my research. Not really research. I'm watching documentaries for fun. Who am I kidding? Let's not make it research. As I was learning more about him, he had a real penchant for young girls. He had a relationship with someone else who was 14 when he was maybe 30. Lots of walks on the beach and talking and this and that and the other thing. And she mentioned, I don't remember her name, that they slept together once, and it was her that initiated it. And right after she did that, he turned her away and wanted nothing to do with her. Now I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit, but he also dated, who's the woman who married Charlie Chaplin? She was a socialite.
I don't know.
And had really... anyway, so he dated her, that woman who was very young. He also had a first wife that was a Nazi. So he was a soldier. He went to military school. He was riding catcher during World War II. The first day of service was D-Day for him. And then he stayed after the liberation in Paris and did all kinds of, like, investigation, interrogating Nazis about what was going on and trying to convict them or gather information to convict them for their crimes against humanity, and ended up sympathizing with and falling in love with a Nazi, which would have been, he could have been court-martialed for that. Brought her back to the state, and they weren't well-suited for each other, so they ended up getting divorced. But there are other series, too, and I don't really like Red Ice Radio or Freeman Fly, who's another conspiracy theorist, but there is a whole body of analysis around Catcher that states that Salinger may have been involved in some sort of MK Ultra-ish type of thing, and that perhaps the book was written to co-opt the teenagers and get them interested in drugs and turn them against parents and all of the values in our culture, to make them worthless in society. And in some of the stuff that I looked at, you know, says that, you know, the actual Robert Burns poem that the title of Catcher comes from, are you familiar with the poem?
What are you saying about Pelham?
Okay,
Pelham?
No, poem. P-O-E-M. There's a poem. There's a Robert Burns poem that is Catcher in the Rye comes from. You know, when a body meets a body coming across the rye. Well, they say that there's these conspiracy theorists, that there's a different version of the poem that's when a body fucks a body coming across the rye. How it's like not about kids going off a cliff into adulthood and Holden Caulfield wanting to catch them from having to run like a lemming over the cliff into adulthood and be part of the fake New York Park Avenue lousy with rings scene. That it's about pedophilia. And, I mean, it is pretty pervy for a 53-year-old man to be interested in 18-year-old girls, if you ask me. And one of the points that Joyce made that I found so interesting was, here are all these people totally worshiping J.D. Salinger, wondering what in the world he's been writing. And he had this bunker. I don't know if you knew that, but he, in seclusion, would get up every day and put on like a mechanic's jumpsuit and go into this bunker and write. And he had provisions and things in there so that he totally ignored his family. One of his wives left him because she was so neglected, and his daughter has written a book, and I guess he was just a horrible father. But here, Joyce's point is everybody's been wondering what he's been writing, and there are many things that he has been writing. They're going to be published starting, I guess, last year and moving into 2020, a complete anthology of everything that has to do with the Glass family, and those are like the Franny and Zooey books and Raised High the Roof and Carpenter and all that, and then a complete Whatever Happened to Holden Caulfield. So he did write prolifically, but in addition, he was writing to all sorts of other young girls. And right after he got rid of Joyce, he was writing to someone else's au pair. And Joyce felt the need some years later to go back and say something to him, to get some closure from him. So she went to his house and knocked on the door, and he chewed her out and said she was worthless and she would never amount to anything because she believed in the world and all this stuff. And that au pair girl was living with him. So he was writing, in addition to writing novels, he was writing to letters to a bunch of young girls, and it seems, perhaps, that part of the reason why he wanted to be in seclusion was because he wanted to have these inappropriate relationships.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, and I don't want to be, like, paranoid about them. I did like Catcher in the Rye. The last time I read it was in the last 8 years, so I have read it as an adult. And I'm so surprised that this is what I picked up on.
What got you into this? How did you even begin to look into them? You just saw a documentary by accident?
Well, no, I put the documentary on my Netflix queue to get as a DVD because I'm writing. And so, you know, I got to look at Gravity's Rainbow. I've got to look at all this good stuff, the classic literature again as an adult. And so, I mean, in this, we're doing What Youth Now, and I thought, for heaven's sake, this is the person who Holden Caulfield was the first teenager. So wouldn't it make sense to look at it?
Mm-hmm.
But as I went down the rabbit hole, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Right. You thought he'd be a pretty admirable character, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And maybe go ahead.
No, so here's what I first started reading about him in the 90s in New York when Ron Rosenbaum would occasionally do an article. So I go to Ron Rosenbaum's Slate.com site, and the first thing I see, he's done an article recently on Salinger. It's called Salinger, the Swamis, and the Secrets. And it says, new letters shed light on J.D. Salinger's spiritual life and reinforce the need for his estate to come clean about what, if any, works remain locked in the vault. And Ron Rosenbaum is sort of an investigative journalist, so he's on his tail, trying to find out. So I'll send you this article. Ron Rosenbaum is a very interesting journalist. But back then, I came across LaRouche somewhere, maybe in the 80s, and it was the first time I heard of it, that J.D. Salinger was part of Operation Mind Control. The whole Catcher in the Rye was a major operation to screw up the minds of America youth. And now you're telling me, I didn't know this, that it's bloomed. There's all kinds of stuff on this aspect of Salinger as a military operation, right?
And not to mention the number of assassins who have had Catcher in the Rye in their apartment, in their hand. John Lennon's assassin, and I can't keep all the assassins straight, was that Arvold, had Catcher in the Rye?
Oswald is Kennedy. Mark Chapman is Lennon.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I don't know my assassins. But I think Oswald may have had it on his coffee table along with three other books, so it wasn't like a dead...
Okay.
Correlation, but he at least had it in his library, which one could argue, since the book has sold like 60 million copies and continues to sell 250,000 copies per year, it's highly likely that he would have it in his apartment, but still. So the super paranoid conspiracy theory guys, this one, Joe Atwill, has written an article, a lengthy article, called The Freemason and the Rye. And it is somewhat tedious because he's the type of guy that, like, anybody who has a checkerboard floor in their home is a Mason. And, you know, that type of thing where it's like there's nothing good in the world because everybody's, you know, fucking
mind control. Let's not go into that too much. Let's not go into that. I want to give you a counter position. So looking up, Catcher in the Rye comes out in 1951. McLuhan's Mechanical Bride comes out in 1951. Now, I always thought of McLuhan as countering any intelligence operation that was coming out in youth culture. So what's interesting about Holden Caulfield, he's the first alienated teenager. Every teenager is pissed off in the 50s, 60s for who knows why. Psychologists will say, well, it's just the Oedipal battle and this and that. But McLuhan came in saying, to counter the MK Ultra idea, you could say that McLuhan purposely came up with the idea, well, television is making these kids different from their print-oriented parents. So McLuhan, I often thought, countered Salinger, with a different, I'll say it this way. This spiritual archetype that's supposed to be is in Holden Caulfield that the kids identify with, and then it carries on with Franny and Zooey novels, is that McLuhan comes on and he emphasizes Hermann Hesse and Siddhartha and the popularity of that in '68, and he's going to come up with a different reason for why the kids are going into Buddhism and wherever the alienation of the archetype of Holden Caulfield leads to, and he wants to counter it. So McLuhan was trying to come up with another reason to counter the apparent spirituality of a Holden Caulfield.
Ooh. That's really interesting.
There was, yeah, so that when McLuhan says the kids naturally go east, go for Buddhism because linear Christianity doesn't work anymore, you see the content of J.D. Salinger's Catch and Rye totally matches that. And then especially mm-hmm. Franny and Zooey, because they're little smart New York kids who are intrigued by Buddhism or anti-logic and things like that. And it's actually mm-hmm. quite, it could be, it's so simple. It could be profiled. It could be based on a computer printout, the way they write about Franny and Zooey, the way Holden Caulfield is designed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a lot of conspiracy theory around it. But you could actually look at McLuhan as countering J.D. Salinger, trying to come up with a different way of thinking about why the kids were attracted to Buddhism.
Hmm.
So anyway, that's what... That's as far as I thought about it for the last 20 years or so. But now here's this new article, Salinger, the Swamis, and the Secrets. You see, it's got everything in there. It's got the Buddhism, the Swamis, the Hinduism. It's got kids interested in secrets and partly the whole International Connection show with Bob Marshall was designed that way. We were trying to attract the Holden Caulfields just like we are now trying to do it. And we've come across these parallel worlders, the What Youth Gang, who are mm-hmm. in the Holden Caulfield meme, and I try to provide something, a different way to go through youth, different ideas than the traditional trend. Now, Salinger recognizes that, you know, fame is not too cool, but he creates a secret cult where he's the antidote to the fame.
Yeah, and his silence... that he wasn't a complete recluse. That's the other thing. He still was seeing people. He was doing things. He was going to county fairs in Cornish. He would fly different places where he wanted to go. He just wanted everything on his terms. And so it was kind of, you know, I can't decide if it was like a put on, something calculated, or if he was just kind of mentally ill, or maybe like just
right.
really super shell-shocked from having to go in and clean up after the Nazis. Because that would
right.
that would have really, I mean, he was quoted as saying that you can't get the burning flesh out of your nostrils, the smell of the burning flesh out of your nostrils, one of the famous things that he said. I mean, that would, he did have a nervous breakdown at one point.
Yeah.
After
okay, let's see. Let's see what the others. Everybody's open. Does anybody want to comment on this? Do people know about this book, Holden Caulfield?
No.
It really doesn't resonate with the youth of today. That no one likes it who's under 30.
Right, right. No, you're right. That's why it's very important to be. This is the beginning book. This is the beginning of teen culture. You know, it's really important that you brought this up.
Yeah, that was interesting. Oh. I've never read it, but now that you're bringing it up, it sounds like something worth looking into.
Say it again, Jermaine.
I said I've never read the book, but I was looking it up right now. And it sounds something, like, worth looking into.
Yeah, I'll send you the J.D. Sound, the Ron Rosenbaum article to everybody. Chad, did you know about this book? Did you ever read it?
I read Catcher in the Rye, yeah, in high school. I read it in one night, the day before a book report was due.
Did it have any impact on you?
A bit, you know, just about like being out, being young and out alone in the city. Made me imagine forward a few years ahead, a few years later, when I ended up like traveling around North America by myself. So maybe that, and I think On the Road and Catcher in the Rye probably inspired me a bit to do those things.
Yes, that's
to enjoy the experience of being a young person out alone in the cold without any preparation from parents or anything.
Right.
Well, let me ask you this, Bob. Holden Caulfield, like, he's drinking way too much. He's chain smoking. He's seeing a prostitute. He goes to see a teacher, and the teacher kind of fondles him when he's sleeping on the couch, and he runs out and leaves his tie there. Like, what do you think of that? Like, it didn't seem like he was a really, like, there's something cool about, like, smoking a bunch of pot and going to Burning Man, to me. I mean, I'm too old for all that now, but if I think back to fun stuff as a youth, like, that sounds kind of fun, but just, like, walking around getting drunk, chain smoking tobacco and sleeping with a prostitute seems really beyond angst to me, and like depression. So,
well, they don't have to. The high school girls are given away for free, so you don't need to do that anymore. So the world's totally changed. And the whole,
got it.
So
okay.
the beatnik thing is phase two. You know, in 57, 58. So this, forgot that Holden, I've been doing the beatnik thing a little bit, but I forgot about Holden Caulfield. That started it. Youth culture. So then the beatniks. I don't have much to say about it other than it's very appropriate. I'm interested in what other people have to say about it. Let's see. Anybody else want to say something? Is Kate here? Jed? What's happening? Kate? Nadia. Is Nadia still here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, yeah. Do you know about this Holden Caulfield Catching the Rye world?
This is very interesting. This is the first time that I even hear about this book, and it sounds really interesting, though.
Yeah, I mean, it shows up with Assassins. Shows up in Assassins. I mean, it totally looks like an MKUltra kind of book. Subsequently, many years later, and you guys didn't know about it because the issues in it are really old-fashioned for your generation. But it is the it is something you guys should know about because it was the beginning of youth culture. This is just before Rock Around the Clock, just before rock and roll, and the kids are growing up. Alienated, and they're also a new commercial niche market that the corporations are looking at. So it begins with Holden Caulfield. Holden Caulfield, hold the call. Yeah, like they hung up. They're alienated. They're not plugged into their radio world of their parents.
So that was in the 50s, Bob?
Yeah, the book came out in 51. I mean, barely out of World War II. You're just beginning Korean War. That's the gray area of the 50s. The McCarthyism is dominating. It's the no fun 50s. The 50s are no fun from 50 to 55. Then Rock Around the Clock comes out with Bill Haley and the Comets, and then Elvis, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and then the last 5 years of the 50s is really great, you know, for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the dark period, when people thought, the CIA thought they could mind control people's minds, they thought the messages controlled people, they thought the propaganda had to be a certain way, they would think they could control the minds of youth. And so they might come up with a project like Catcher in the Rye. And LaRouche would say that the elites were Buddhist, they were not Christian, and or you know, like Catholic Thomist Christians. And we're not talking about being like Jim Baker or Jimmy Swaggart, the European Catholic stuff. You had a Cardinal Spellman was a very popular TV speaker in the 50s. So the Catholic Church was doing pretty good in the early 50s. So a faction in the CIA or in the elites wanted to move American kids away from the influence of Christianity and go into Buddhism or Hinduism. And most of the counterculture, and this is what the line that LaRouche takes, is built to counter a healthy Catholic upbringing. Now, McLuhan comes in, and he provides a comprehensive alternative Catholicism to what the Pope was offering. That's where McLuhan is relevant. And he actually succeeds in getting youth attention, but everybody else says that McLuhan is trying to get people to go Buddhist, which is not true. So it gets all mixed up in the 60s, in the information overload in the global theater, and nobody's having influence on anybody, and the kids just start living on their own. And they start the counterculture in Haight-Ashbury in New York City and Los Angeles, with Zappa being a major figurehead in that, the leader, until the Grateful Dead came along. And then you have this guy, David McGowan, who just died November 22nd, saying there was a whole CIA conspiracy coming out of Zappa's home called the Log Cabin. So that's a later phase. And then you get in the 70s and 80s, then nobody is a teenager anymore. Everybody's 4 years old. All ages are 4 years old. Everybody's having a massive identity crisis. Virtual reality's coming in, and these kind of issues about Holden Caulfield, you know, controlling kids' minds, is not that relevant anymore. The kids don't even have families.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get into the super McLuhan level. And then I intervene in the 80s, and it took me 30 years to win, to save the youth. And now we have saved them, and they don't give a fuck until Jermaine found our colleagues here in Hawaii, the What Youth website. Finally, finally we find our audience.
You know, Bob, I have noticed, like, now this kind of triggers something in my mind, that was happening in the 50s, and then there was no youth after like the 60s and all that. But I started noticing when I would watch movies, old movies from the 50s or in design, as far as architect design, furniture design, I felt like if you just watch what was happening in the 50s, it feels almost like something came to a stop and it didn't continue to develop in that direction, and there was like something really like a disruption in the 60s 70s, and that design part, architect furniture, it was never recovered, and we still in architecture are looking at homes back in the 50s calling them modern still. So I felt
right,
and I always thought, what happened during the 50s that like there was, it feels that it, there was no movement. Something was,
well, that's because the technology changed. See, that's where McLuhan comes in. 50s is black and white TV. And so the tactile sensorium of black and white TV is molding people secretly. But that means the previous environment becomes the art form. And, yeah, this mic is crummy. Hey, Carol? Yeah, what do we do? Is it because you're on that other phone?
No, it's because you have your mouth spitting into your
microphone. Well, where's it supposed to be?
There.
Oh, okay. But also listening. So you have to look at the content of the 50s is the radio environment. Radio comes in our form. That's jazz and maybe marijuana. So the quality, the texture of the 50s is due to the hidden effect of television. Then you have the satellite world, the computer world, and black and color TV in the 60s. That's going to make the whole project of the 50s disappear. Just like, now we'll bring in something, I don't know if you guys know this, Mark from Colorado, I guess is where he is, who works at Home Depot, told us this fascinating story on Saturday. The management at Home Depot put out a call for kids, 16-year-olds, to come and get these jobs at Home Depot. And unfortunately, the kids are on their cell phones, and they have to apply for this pretty free job, great opportunity, through the computer. So the management told Mark that after a few months they're getting nowhere because the kids refuse to get off their cell phones, refuse to fill out the application forms because it requires not using their cell phone and doing a computer. And the management at Home Depot can only process it on computer. So they have this impasse where they can't get kids that they need, and the kids are missing their opportunities to get a job or something there. There's an example of a technology cutting off something.
Mm-hmm.
The cell phone is cutting them off from the management, or like one phase back. So you should understand from what we're saying that the reason the 50s comes to an end is the 50s got aborted by a whole different texture of media in the 60s. And then the 70s are different from the 60s. The 60s got stopped. Then the 70s were different. The 80s were different. Every decade's different. All right? So that's how you look at this. That's how you know. You just have to look at the technical qualities of the media environment to see why every decade is getting aborted. See? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, is there a reason that it's in decades and 10 years rather than 5 or even, you know, is there a reason for it always being decades?
The journalism likes to name a decade, but it isn't really decades. It depends on when the technology comes in. Like, take the first part of the 70s, they get altered by the middle 70s by cable TV. And they began to have those satellite dishes. So the second half of the 70s would be different from the first half. But journalism likes to make iconic statements, so they'll call the 70s the me decade. But it's not accurate. So we shouldn't think in decades unless you're talking to a journalist, and then you want to correct the journalist. But that would be my explanation. The first half of the 80s, basically the changes seem to be every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the end of the McCarthy era in 54-55 makes a different second half of the 50s. The second half of the 60s is different from the first half. Second half of the 70s is different from the first half. Just take the 70s, you got progressive rock and James Taylor and then depressing rock, and then all of a sudden it goes into disco and punk in the second half. The early 80s is the farmers committing suicide. I don't know what music. Even Zappa made lousy albums in the early 80s. And then Reagan kind of gets nailed in the middle 80s. And then it's a different atmosphere after the middle of the 80s. I don't know what the music scene is there. Zappa actually is the king in the late 80s. And then you have Seattle in the early 90s. And then the second half of the 90s is people getting on computers and Napster. So actually a decade doesn't last 10 years anymore. But the journalists don't know that. Is 347, is that Eliza?
Jury.
347. Okay. Let's see this one.
Bob, did you hear Yuri say it was Yuri?
Yes, I heard that.
Yuri? Okay, sorry.
Yes, I muted Yuri.
Okay.
Now, 937, is that Sarah?
No, Bob, it's Kevin.
Good. Oh, okay. What do you have to say, Kevin?
You know, I just listened to all the Catcher in the Rye stuff, and I really liked that book when I was in high school. Holden Caulfield was like the James Dean character. I mean, except he was around all of his cronies. He was always talking about it, how much he hated everyone, but at the same time, he would just destroy himself with cigarettes and smoking and just hating everyone. But that's what I remember of Catcher in the Rye.
That's pretty accurate. That's good.
It is.
Yeah, and this hating everyone is what... You know, it's like the literate teenager. I don't know if Mickey Rooney in the 30s had that problem, but he didn't represent that. Well, you know, the teenage, whatever they were called, adolescents before World War II. So there were that kind of teen stuff, but they were not alienated kids. They were happy, ebullient, do-gooder kids, from what I remember, in the 30s. And Mickey Rooney was one of the main figures. So what made the kids become alienated, you know, in the 50s, and ever since then, it's nothing but alienation. You know, go into Janis Ian, the young folk singer. Nothing but it. Who is it today? Is Taylor? Now, Taylor Swift. Okay, what's that clicking? Let me find out. Who's doing the clicking? Is it me? It's probably OJ. So I'm gonna... Nope, not OJ. It got everybody unmuted, except for Yuri. Wonder what that clicking is. Hey, everybody, I'm going to mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
Seems to stop it. Okay, Jermaine, Chad, OJ, unavailable, anonymous. Oh, yeah, it might have been OJ. Okay, yes, everybody's unmuted. So I've had a lot of neat synchronicity last few weeks, but one of them was a guy named Peter Stampfel, who was a singer for the Holy Modal Rounders and also in the Fugs in the 60s. Well-known guy, and he called me out of the blue. I've never spoken to him in my life. I've heard him on Bob Fass. He's 77 years old, and he wanted to know if I knew where Dean Latimer was. So I helped him do that. But he was telling me, as a 77-year-old eccentric folk singer, he thinks Taylor Swift's a genius. So I know nothing about her, but any of you guys got anything on Taylor Swift? And she's not an alienated kid. Her image is helping everybody, visiting them and giving them a Christmas present, right? Hey. You're all unmuted.
Yeah.
The only thing I really know about Taylor Swift is she kind of started out in the country genre, didn't she? And now she's like just a pop singer now, pretty much.
Yes. But Peter Stample says she's a genius. He says when you make a song, usually one-third of it is correct or effective. He says all three-thirds of her songs are effective, and he thinks she's a creative genius. Now, I don't know anything about her, but it's interesting. This old bohemian guy is very intrigued by this plastic Disney girl or whatever she is. Even though, oh, yeah, now I remember, her songs were famous because she got ripped off by all these guys. She had like 10 boyfriends in 6 weeks, right?
All of her music is really relatable. And she usually dates these guys, they break her heart, and she goes and writes about it. And she's really strong, not just with her voice, but like her lyrically. She knows how to write very well. So her music
right.
is very relatable. So as she grew up, and that's right, she started out with a country music out in, I think, like Nashville or something like that. However, growing up and going into that teenage, like, stage, she would talk about everything that she was going through, which all these little girls were able to relate, and that's why I think she's such a big deal, because all of her music is relatable.
Again, she's a female Holden Caulfield. She's complaining about the guys all the time, about her relationship.
Right, mm-hmm.
They're all phony.
No, but she's
They're
not negative about it. But she doesn't hate
that's
like
right.
She overcomes it. Her song is Shake It Off. Like, while you're getting down about what he said to you, you could be getting down to this thick beat, is one of her lyrics, or something like that.
Right.
And her looks are really chameleon-like. She's tall and lanky. She can wear anything. She can dance in any way. She's relatively wholesome. She's never been slutty. She's not twerking. I mean, and I'm no proof. Twerk away.
Well, but, it's funny because she dates a lot of guys, so they make fun of her for dating a lot of guys. It's just the way that she goes about it. It doesn't look slutty. But if we look at her track record, she's dated a lot of guys, a lot of throughout
yes.
her in the public.
That's
so
a good
I think
point
that that's.
For me.
That's when you put some type of balance, when you can date different guys, but when you're not slutty about it, you get away with it. When you're slutty about it, like, what's the other girl that does twerk and she's all over the place? Then, you know, it's just
Miley.
Almost bad publicity. Miley Cyrus, yes.
Yep.
Well, I think it's because she doesn't sleep with them that she doesn't come across slutty, but then they break up with her because she doesn't sleep with them.
How do you know she doesn't sleep with them?
according to the whatever people are saying, the
you know, what I've read. And she's very
confident. Well, it's not like Britney Spears who was grabbing Kevin Federline's crotch on the balcony in Paris in front of everyone. So, I mean, if she is, she's being discreet about it.
Yeah, right. Right. You're right. She's being discreet.
Who's the one that was the slutty one? Did I miss the... Did you name the other one?
Well, Miley Cyrus, before her,
oh,
Britney
yeah.
Spears, major slut.
Right, right.
I mean, I love Britney, too. I don't care. She can slut it up. I don't have any problem with slut. I don't think Taylor Swift has a good voice, myself. It's strong, but I don't think she's got a beautiful voice. I think she's, and I think if you hose her off, she's not beautiful. She's not as beautiful as Jermaine is, but she puts herself together nicely. Like, she is full throttle with what she has. And she's the only one of the only musicians who's making money right now. So in that sense, I would